Our world was turned upside down last November when we received a call from our son-in-law, Byron, and told us that our daughter had left him and the family and was now living with another man. I share that very rarely, but I do that on occasion for one reason, and that is that friends who come to know us will make it a point in prayer to remember us. We have four children. We have a boy on each end. And Kurt, our oldest, runs the radio ministry in California. He's really the chief operating officer of that and does a magnificent job. He's bright like his mother and has her mind and is just thinks like she does and puts it together so well, works so well with people, and is a real servant at heart, never pulls rank because of his name, and we like that. Our youngest lives in Nashville and would love to pursue a career in the world of sound and music, just finishing a little home they built there in Brentwood. Kurt and Deb, our oldest, have three, and Chuck and Jenny have one, and they'll soon have a second. And our younger daughter is married to a pastor who is pastoring a church north of Santa Barbara, in a little community called Solvang. It's a Danish community. Christmas time, you'd almost think Charles Dickens was living there. It's one of those quaint, lovely, delicate towns of about 6,000, 7,000 people and have about 2 million tourists a year. So it's a good and bad part of that job. He's doing a magnificent job. Went to the wrong seminary, but he's a wonderful guy. He studied at Trinity. I'm trying to get him to Dallas so he can learn the Bible. And I think he'll come and probably take our PhD course. He's certainly able to do that. And I think he really belongs in teaching, but that's another subject. And they have three adorable children, Ashley and Austin, and the youngest is Jonathan. But Carissa. Sort of the butterfly of my life. She came to us in a very wonderful way. We almost lost her through a car accident where a drunk hit our car and totaled it in Houston. Very icy winter day, and we had already lost a baby, so we feared losing another. So she was a very special gift to us, and so she became for me a very special person, maybe too special. And married a marvelous man 14 years ago who works for the Ronald Blue Company out of Atlanta and opened their West Coast office along with his brother-in-law, George Andrews. George and Byron were building the business, and just out of the blue, it seemed, Carissa walked out. Our faculty knows all about it. Many of our students know about it. I'm not the type to live in silent misery, though there are many things no one knows that Cynthia and I go through on a somewhat regular basis. But it almost... It almost finished me off. And I must have in my mind written a resignation a half dozen times. And we fell into a real dark period of about 4 months, from November till February into March. I don't even remember Thanksgiving or Christmas or New Year's. It was all a blur. We were just moving into our home. We were surrounded by boxes and all, and of course we didn't feel like unpacking. And we didn't sleep in our bed for 3.5 months. She slept on the sofa and I slept on a chair. And we burned 2 cords of firewood trying to figure out how we go on through the pain of that period of time. Several friends came by, and all of the family at the seminary loved us and cared for us. They didn't know what to say. We didn't know what to do. And I found in the few occasions when I've shared the story that it invariably links me with people who before then were not linked to me. Because folks have a misunderstanding about me and about my life. And that's understandable. I'm sure I have a misunderstanding about a person's life that I admire and appreciate. But this pain that entered our world has, it's not been the first experience, but it's been the most difficult experience we've gone through. So when I meet couples like many of you who in a very brief moment share something like, we're going through a hard time with one of our kids, there's a place in my heart for you that's reserved for you. And I understand better than I ever would have, having lost what we once had in a daughter. We've seen her twice since last November. Neither time was pleasant. And we have thought of every possible thing you can think of as to the cause, and we don't know. I begin this talk tonight because I want to talk about pain. I want to talk about suffering. We've had a lot of fun. We'll keep having fun this weekend, but this is a little interlude where we come to reality regarding the underbelly of life, the dark side. Joseph Parker, one of the great preachers of 100 and more years ago in Great Britain, used to say to young ministers, preach to broken hearts and you'll never lack for a congregation. There's one in every pew. If you could know the pain in the person sitting next to you or behind you, you would be absolutely shocked. The pain that people have known and live with is at times off the chart. You would not have known the pain of our last November if I had not told you. And I tell you that because to illustrate the fact that we all carry heartache, suffering. We don't want it, but it's there. And there will be more. People have given it pain different names, haven't they? Scott Peck calls it the road less traveled. And his opening line in his book is, life is difficult. I think it's the best line in the book. It's true, life is difficult. C.S. Lewis says, God whispers to us in our pleasure, but he shouts in our pain. It's God's megaphone. Philip Yancey calls it the gift nobody wants. Isaac Watts asked a question over 270 years ago that the church is still asking, am I a soldier of the cross, a follower of the Lamb? Shall I fear to own his cause or blush to speak his name? Are there no foes for me to face? Must I not stem the flood? Is this vile world a friend of grace to help me on to God? Great questions. Foes to face, grace to endure. I wish I could promise all of you that our heaviest level of pain is behind us rather than in front of us, but I can't say that. It may be around the corner for one of you. Maybe next week, maybe next year. It may be behind you. I hope it is. But I know that pain is a part of God's curriculum, and it's a required course. It's not an elective. And I don't know of anything that humbles us like pain. I've used a line for years. I read somewhere, I wish I could find the source. Pain plants the flag of reality in the fortress of a rebel heart. Very few proud people on hospital beds tonight. Very few proud people dying with a dread disease. It humbles us. And I find it's these are threads woven through the tapestry of God's truth. They appear and reappear. They come in different ways. There isn't a life in the Scriptures without pain. Interesting. We like the victory stories. We like the walls collapsing. We like the Red Sea opening. We love the scenes where God does these miracles. We like the tomb empty. We don't like the 3 days before it. We don't like the disillusionment 2 days after crucifixion. We like to hurry to the, we like Easter. We don't like it is finished. And in life, I find that there are few Easters. There are many, many sorrows. He was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And if we are to be like him, interestingly, Paul uses the word in Philippians 3:10 of the fellowship of his sufferings. There was one of those nights sitting on that chair that I went through a real period of disillusionment about all of this. And I wondered, why God had let this happen. I struggled with his goodness. Like any one of you, I found myself bargaining. After all I've done for you, how could you do this to me, you know? As if I got some big deal on that. And I thought of Job, who didn't respond like that. Job said in chapter 23, verse 10, he knows the way that I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot has held his steps. His way have I kept and not declined. Neither have I turned back from the command of his lips. Now get this line. I have esteemed the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. Isn't that a great line? Why? Because he had lost everything. You know, I like chapter 42 in Job, but I have to remember that there's 41 other chapters. That's Job's life. And you think of Job, what do you think of suffering? That's why he's great. Tozer said this, it's doubtful God can use anyone greatly till he's hurt him deeply. So if you are being hurt, and if you have been hurt, it's part of the greatness preparation. As we get deeper into the subject, I want to give you several scriptures that may be of help to you. They're scriptures that I wrote down back then. They're on a little handwritten yellow tablet I had by the table as I sat waiting for the phone to ring that never rang. Philippians 1:29, for to you it has been granted for Christ's sake not only to believe in him but also to suffer. Philippians 1:29. John 16:33, in me you may have peace, but in the world, you have tribulation. Peace, perfect peace in Christ. But in the world, there's no shalom. James 1, 2 and 3, verses 2 and 3. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Paraphrased in the Phillips, when all kinds of trials and temptations crowd into your lives, my brothers, don't resent them as intruders, but welcome them as friends. Realize they come to test your faith and to produce in you the quality of endurance. Let the process go on until the endurance is fully developed, and you will find you have become people of mature character with the right sort of independence. It's a magnificent paraphrase of James 1, 2 through 4. 1 Peter 4, 12, beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you which comes upon you for your testing as though some strange thing were happening to you. That's a command. And the tendency on our part when suffering occurs is surprise. When in fact it ought to be, it's just as God said it would be. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 12, indeed all who desire to live godly in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. You know, it just occurs to me, and I remember reading in, the other day in Acts, when Paul was converted, chapter 9, and remember Ananias was dispatched to go see him? I don't know if you remember the message God gave Ananias, but listen to this. Maybe you'd never have heard this before. Acts 9, verse 15. The Lord said to Ananias, go to Paul, go, for he is a chosen instrument of mine to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. Verse 16, for I will show him how much he must suffer for my name's sake. You know that was in there? Ananias, I want you to go and I want you to be with Paul. Ananias was afraid of going. Paul was a Christian killer. I mean, it wasn't an easy assignment. It's like going to a converted Mickey Cohen type person, okay? I mean, or some other person. And he goes and he says, I want you to tell him how much he's going to suffer. Here are three psalms out of the longest psalm. Listen, Psalm 119. Look at verse 67. Before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now I keep thy word. There's something about affliction that drives me back to the cross. Drives me to my knees. Before I was afflicted, I went my own way. But now I keep thy word. And then verse 71. It is good for me. Psalm 119, 71. It's good for me that I was afflicted, that I may learn thy statutes. Affliction makes you teachable. Makes you sensitive. It helps your ears perk up to things that you would otherwise let pass. Hey, here's verse 75 of that psalm. I know, O Lord, that thy judgments are righteous and that in faithfulness thou hast afflicted me. And here's one I found just recently in Ecclesiastes 7, verses 13 and 14. Listen to these words, wise words. Consider the work of God. For who is able to straighten what he has bent? In the day of prosperity, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider. That's all it says. Consider. Talk about a word pregnant with meaning. In the day of prosperity, be happy. But in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. If you and I are going to believe in a sovereign God, then let's not ignore the fact that, like Job says, he is the one who also has the right to take as well as give. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I wanted all four children close. I wanted all four walking with him. I pray that all four would love him with the passion of their mom and dad. But they all four don't. That's very hard for me. So there's not only a heartache in every pew, there are heartaches in the pulpit. All of this bringing me to 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. I don't want to cast a pall on our conference together, but I just felt the real leading of God to address this subject, lest it look like life at the seminary is all fun and games. and we don't know the pain of things. God has really tested us in this semester. You who are close to us know this. Dr. Pentecost said to me the other day as we were walking across the campus, you know, Chuck, Dorothy and I realized that in the 40 plus years we've been around here, we've never known a semester like this one for serious testing. Two of our profs have had brain tumors, one the size of a baseball. One of our profs is at Mayo Clinic right now with some exotic disease that we think is viral encephalitis, but it may not be that. He was a specimen of health 6-8 months ago. He is now in a wheelchair, sometime not able even to push the wheels to get to his study. I drove him home the other evening after a funeral I'd preached. And I'll tell you about the funeral in a minute. But Dan was not able to even get the wheelchair in the back of his van. And then we've lost a student or two. And we've lost, did the student wife die last week? Got a student wife who just had a baby. She's too weak to hold her baby, dying with cancer. She's dying with cancer. And his little husband's home with a 2-year-old and a baby, 3-month-old baby. Good night. And our beloved friend, David Edwards, taking a shower one morning, slumps in the shower. Wife finds him not breathing. We buried him several weeks ago. Specimen of health. Probably didn't have 10% body fat. Worked out. Avid tennis player. Wonderful mind. What is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little while, then vanishes away. We ought to say, if we live, then we will do this or that. It's easy to miss that little conditional clause, isn't it? If we live, we will do this or that. So it's been a journey through a valley for us. And our students, if they haven't learned before, are learning, even in the family of our community, our little community at the seminary of 1,500 folks, they're learning that the pain falls on faculty as well as student, on women as well as men, on children as well as older. And death comes, bears some of us away. So, to set the record straight, let me mention two facts to begin with. The first is that suffering is inevitable. If you're not convinced of that by now, you haven't been listening, haven't been awake. Suffering is inevitable. There is no getting around it. It is as common to the believer as apple pie and baseball is to our country. It is life. Teach your children that. Teach your grandchildren that. I love cuddling with our grandchildren, and every once in a while I remember I have a role with them that my grandfather had with me. And my need is to talk at times real straight to them. Though they have wonderful parents who are doing that. I think one of the jobs of grandparents is to help our grandchildren know what great parents they have. Not great grandparents they have, but great parents they have. I think one of our jobs is to help them know the long view of life. We've lived longer than their parents. And they love that. They respect that. I used to love my granddad's white hair. I used to love it that he had lived in an era that was to me almost a novelty. I was enraptured with his stories. And if I'm not careful, I'll give all my stories to people other than my grandchildren. We were once a storytelling country, weren't we? And then we bought a box that made pictures and talked to us, and now it entertains us every night. Pain, suffering is inevitable. those verses I gave you. Learn them. Remind yourself of them. So you won't have your legs cut out from under you like ours were last November. That horrible night when that phone rang at midnight. The second fact worth writing down and remembering is that pain is essential. Not only is suffering inevitable, pain is essential. From the road less traveled, we mature. From God's megaphone, we hear messages we would otherwise miss. By means of the gift nobody wants, we unwrap wisdom. Suffering is instructional. It helps us perceive life correctly. It helps us interpret and evaluate and examine events with the long view in mind. I don't know how it does it, I just know it does. It breeds reality, which is so valuable for our younger friends in this generation who live for instant gratification and overnight success. Now, take the Thessalonians, for example. Paul really wanted to be with them, but he couldn't get there. He says that he couldn't get there, even though he tried. Look at verse 14 of chapter 2. You, brethren, became imitators of the churches of God in Christ that are in Judea, so for you also endured the same sufferings at the hand of your countrymen. So these Thessalonians began to suffer. These were the ones who killed the Lord Jesus and the prophets and drove us out. The same ones that attacked Paul began to attack those who followed Paul's teaching. Verse 16, they hindered us from speaking to the Gentiles. Verse 17, we've been bereft of you for a short time, in person, not in spirit. We were all the more eager with great desire to see your face. We wanted to come to you more than once, but Satan stopped us. That's another whole world, the world of darkness, the world of demonic activity and satanic infiltration. We haven't even talked about that. I think if you and I could see the other world, we would be shocked. If we could see the activity of demons or the presence of angels, we would be shocked as they move around our campus and in and around your home and church and wherever there are those times of conflict and testing and temptation. You would be amazed at the presence of demonic activity. He says Satan stopped us. I have a little caricature of Satan that my sister gave me. She and I do fun things together, and you've got to really love your brother to give him a little caricature of Satan. And this is a little creature that's painted red, has a little nose that turns up, has little sinister eyes, has a little tail, has a little pitchfork, and he bumps up and down a little spring. And he used to have a little sign that came out of his head that said, "Go to hell." It used to come out like this. I love this little caricature because she thought, well, if I give it to my brother, I probably ought to repaint that little sign. And so she, with very delicate hand painting, she whites out that line and she puts, "Welcome." So when you push this little thing down, it goes, "Welcome." And that's the only part of the little caricature that's true. The devil isn't red, doesn't have sinister eyes, he doesn't have a pitchfork, doesn't have a little tail, he doesn't pop up and down, he isn't cute, he doesn't sit on our shoulder whispering ugly little things in our ears. He is brilliant. He is fascinating. He is delightful, desirous. He has been at it for centuries. He knows you through and through. He knows the truth that you love that dooms him. And his emissaries carry out his activity and they despise us as much as their master. And how easy to live half our lives not ever even thinking about the presence of the wicked one. Don't think because he is not as active here as he may be on Haitian soil or in the midst of the bush of Africa or some other continent I could name, don't think he is not at work. And graduation 2 years ago, we were lined up to come in, cap and gown, and two of our graduates were given subpoenas of divorce from their wives. Planned very carefully for that moment. That's the downside of seminary. I don't think I've ever told that publicly, but I had my arms around both of those graduates that day. The great day of their accomplishment and their wives walking out. It didn't just happen. No divorce just happens. So we work hard on marriages, and we try our best to deal with our lives, of the real life of husband, wife. And it's a tough thing on marriages at seminary. It's hard. And we know that. We can't make it easy, but we can help them through it. Demonic activity, satanic involvement. Angelic involvement. It's the other side. Isn't that a fascinating subject, by the way? I happen to be one fascinated by the whole world of angels and the ministry of the Spirit and the unseen part of life, which I think is real. The real life is the unseen part. Paul says, I tried to come, but Satan thwarted us. I don't know what that means. I don't know how. Therefore, verse 1, chapter 3 begins, when we could endure it no longer. He also was a little anxious. Bill, you mentioned having anxiety, and we all felt that. Identity with you, we've known worry. Paul apparently longed. Maybe he worried. I don't know. When we could endure it no longer. So he's churning, wishing to be there. We thought it best to be left behind at Athens alone. And we sent Timothy, our brother, God's fellow worker in the gospel, to strengthen and encourage you as to your faith. By the way, that's one of the great benefits of this weekend. We come together like this, and if it's done its best work, we leave stronger and more encouraged. Don't we? We know there's a pack of people that we had never been with before who are walking to the same cadence and loving the same Lord and going through similar experiences. And so he says, I sent Timothy, my worker, to strengthen and to encourage you as to your faith. If you want to know what to do when you minister elsewhere, you're going to go minister to missionaries, or you're going to go minister somewhere, and you say, I'm just a lay person, I'm not seminary trained or whatever. Hey, just remember this statement. Just think about how you can strengthen and how you can encourage. It always works. It works almost like magic. Strengthen and encourage. So I sent Timothy to do that. Verse 3, so that no one may be disturbed by these afflictions. See, when you're afflicted, when you hurt, when you are in pain, you're demoralized. You're down. You're blue. And your mind plays tricks on you. And so that no one would be disturbed by these afflictions, I sent Timothy, for you know that we have been destined for this, for the afflictions. It's written in the book. It's going to happen. For indeed, verse 4, when we were with you, we kept telling you in advance that we were going to suffer affliction. And so it came to pass, as you know. Like the old line, you know, cheer up, things could get worse. I cheered up. They got worse. It's exactly what God said. You know, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. People leave conferences like this and they go back, and suddenly there's a surprise in the mail you never thought you'd have to open on Sunday night. And it's going to be there. We've got friends that left Mount Hermon after a whole week. It happened to be Howie and Marilyn Stevenson, our music minister. Just wonderful people, known them forever. And one of my messages was a message like this, be ready for whatever. You don't know when you go home what you're going to find. And Howie says, I'll never forget when I went home, I went to our front door and I saw water. Yeah, that's just exactly what they did. I go, oh. And so he said, we walked inside and we went upstairs, and the toilet had overflowed, and the whole floor above the dining room table had given way. And the dining chandelier had come down on the table, and the walls were soaked, and it was a royal mess coming home from this great conference. So, you have that to look forward to. Be encouraged. I'm committed to strengthening and encouraging you, and that's what I'm doing. For this reason, when I could endure it no longer, I sent to find out about your faith, for fear that the tempter might have tempted you and our labor should be in vain. Here it is again. The enemy knows when we're weak. The enemy knew if he couldn't get me to fall, then he could attack me in an area of someone who is near and dear to me. And you know how it is. When the Lord touches us with one of our kids, it just can't touch us any more closely. And it was just absolutely devastating. It's like getting kicked in the nose. It's just like having a, you know, your feet cut out from under you. And Paul says, I sent Timothy because for all I knew that the tempter was really tempting you in the downside of your life. We're gone. All you have is the memory of our visit. You're now getting this church underway, and just test after test is happening. For all I know, you're about to give up. And that can happen. But now he says, Timothy has come to us from you and has brought us good news of your faith and love, and that you always think kindly of us, longing to see us just as also we long to see you. For this reason, brethren, in all our distress and affliction, we were comforted about you through your faith. In all our distress and affliction. He was in Corinth, and his distress and affliction were still there. There are such times. I don't know if you have read much of Solzhenitsyn's works, but the Gulag Archipelago tells an incredible scene of this grand Russian statesman as he is enduring prison. And out of that prison came a new man, as many of you already know. But this line out of that book stands out. It was only when I lay there on rotting prison straw that I sensed within myself the first stirrings of good. Gradually, it was disclosed to me that the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties, but right through every human heart and through all human hearts. So bless you, prison, for having been in my life. Prison made Solzhenitsyn. Concentration camp made Corrie ten Boom. It gave her her audience. The scars and pain and the beatings and the shipwrecks and the stonings and the lacerations of Paul in 2 Corinthians 11 draw us to him. They don't drive us away. Pain is like a magnet. Pulls us closer. I know we can't do it because it's not a proper context, and you wouldn't feel comfortable, and so I would never ask it of you. But the wonderful thing about a friendship is that you have someone to share your scars with. It's one of the great things about a marriage that I have loved over these 42 and a half years. There isn't a thing in my life Cynthia doesn't know. And I don't think there's much in her life that I don't know. So you love each other with an intimate, deep affection. I know all the secret places of the vaults of her life, and she does mine. And as a result of having this closeness, we are completely free with each other. And it's because we don't know that about one another, we feel a sense of distance. Isn't it interesting? Once you know a hard story, you instantly feel closer to that person. Isn't that amazing? I heard Bill Bryan's testimony when we were at a camp site, and ever since I've heard him tell the story of something from his past, I'll leave it to him to tell it if he wishes sometime, but it's made me feel closer to him. Because you would think, you know, all he does is laugh, play the trumpet, have fun, make people see the lighter side of life, but there's a whole dimension of that man that pain has brought. So I what am I saying? I guess I'm saying, don't let it embitter you. It becomes a platform for ministry. If I may, and scenes like this, I think, describe the kind of pain people go through. A Pulitzer Prize winning book is entitled Night by Elie Wiesel. It's an incredible story. François Marac writes the foreword to it. He himself is a French Nobel Prize winning author. And he describes his first meeting with Wiesel. It was then I understood what had first drawn me to the young Israeli. That look, as of a Lazarus risen from the dead, yet still a prisoner within the grim confines where he had stayed, stumbling among shameful corpses. For him, Nietzsche's cry expressed an almost physical reality, God is dead. The God of love, of gentleness, of comfort, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has vanished forevermore. Beneath the gaze of this child in the smoke of a human holocaust exacted by race, the most voracious of all idols. And how many pious Jews have experienced this death on that day, horrible even among those days of horror when this child watched the hanging of another child who, he tells us, had the face of a sad angel. He heard someone behind him in line groan, where is God? Where is he now? People who go through real sorrow and suffering have opened up for them, if they don't become bitter, have opened up for them a magnificent opportunity of ministry. Because I believe that God not only does that which is joyful for us and encouraging, relieving, but he also permits the pain. He knows the loss you've gone through. The loss of a mate, the loss of a child, the loss of health, the loss of part of your body, maybe a period of time when you ran and ruined a part of your reputation. It's all part of it. And so my message this evening, though brief, is really one of reality that says it's not only okay, it's from him. It's his gift that you didn't want. Orrin Crane has written, "Slow me down, Lord. Ease the pounding of my heart by the quieting of my mind. Steady my hurried pace with a vision of the eternal reach of time. Give me amid the confusion of my day the calmness of the everlasting hills. Break the tensions of my nerves and muscles with the soothing music of the singing streams that live in my memory. Teach me the art of taking minute vacations, of slowing down to look at a flower, to chat with a friend, to pat a dog, to smile at a child, to read a few lines from a good book. Slow me down, Lord, and inspire me to send my roots deep into the soil of life's enduring values that I may grow toward my greater destiny. Remind me each day that the race is not always to the swift, that there is more to life than increasing its speed. Let me look up to the towering oak and know that it grew great and strong because it grew slowly and well. Interesting, isn't it, that we are different in every way except a very few. We don't look alike. We don't have the same voice. We don't like the same music. We don't enjoy the same period furniture. We don't drive the same kind of cars. We don't wear the same kind of clothing. We don't have preferences, all of us the same preference for what a great vacation is about. We chose different mates. We live in different parts of the country. We have so many things that are so different. But we all have one thing in common. Pain. When I mention pain, I don't have to explain it to anybody. Every person in this room has been taken advantage of by somebody. We've all known the experience of being ripped off, trusting someone and had them take advantage. We've been hurt physically, emotionally. Some in this room, tragically, have been abused. We all have that pain in common, and the good thing is, the good message is, that our God knows it, and He's there for us. I know a woman who spent some time in a mental hospital, and it was the shame of her experience, of her life. It was a misdiagnosis, resulted in her being hospitalized, and it was back at a time when being in a mental hospital was along the same line as the most shameful of experiences. She just recently, though she's now 60 and more years old, said to me, "You know, I think God wants to use that as a part of my testimony to encourage others who feel the same way." And I thought, what a step of maturity. Christ can use what you have lost, what you have suffered, in a wonderful way, people's lives. It's God's megaphone. We realize, our Father, tonight that in this room that has been so full of laughter and fun, as it should be, and ringing with music and joy, we have journeyed in another direction for these few moments. And we find comfort that you are with us in that journey, that you did not abandon us when we went through that pain. And that in many ways there are dimensions of you we now know better because of the hurt. I realize, Lord, the longer I live, that what we need in life is not more intelligent people, or brighter people, people with a quicker wit. What we need are deeper people. People who help us see the other dimensions that speed erases. And in the superficiality of our age, I pray that you would raise up from this small body of men and women a greater depth, an ability to perceive the pain of another's life and to be there with an arm around that person and an understanding heart. Forgive us, our Father, for our quick judgments, our dogmatic assertions when we hardly know another individual's pain. Help us become increasingly more patient and gentle and kind as we grow older and deeper. For we love you, our Father, tonight in a very special way.